Welcome to Pushback, a social justice podcast produced and distributed by Philadelphia Magazine and Word Radio. What's up, everybody? This is Flood the Drummer.
This is Malcolm Burnley.
And thank you for downloading Pushback. Today we're talking about the politics of pot, particularly who can smoke it, where, and why. And so, Malcolm, before we did this episode, you put out some content, some social media content to just get some reader feedback on what people were thinking about pot and how the social attitudes are changing. It was a pretty robust dialogue on social media. Some people felt like they were being reamed in a debate, and others were just kind of like charging ahead. But tell me what you found.
So this started by, we put out a call just for how people's attitudes are changing about marijuana and also marijuana enforcement. And we got one tweet from @GoldBerta, who initially said, "Seems awfully silly not to legalize it, regulate it, tax it. What's the downside in that plan?" And I put out the idea of, well, a lot of people are bothered by the odor of marijuana. A lot of people who maybe are not familiar with it or don't smoke it or don't consume it have complained a lot about how even since decriminalization in Philadelphia, there's been a lot more smelling of weed just when you walk down the street. I mean, it could be 8 in the morning, it could be 8 at night. So I put out the idea of, where is it going to be legal? Could it be banned in public but allowed in legalized in private? And Chris Goldstein, who is one of our guests on today's episode, who's a marijuana activist, and GoldBerta, who originally put out the tweet, got into a lengthy discussion and exchange of, you know, I guess the public's access to marijuana and where it should be, and if it should be to confined to limited areas, say if there was a, instead of a beer garden, there was say a pot garden. And Chris Goldstein was obviously really vehement in pushing back and saying that, you know, marijuana users should have rights just like people who drink alcohol.
Also, so I think that's an issue of equity and opportunity that we miss in the pot debate, because it's about who's getting licenses most times and, you know, who's getting arrested for it. But I think the conversation of where it can be used is just as much an opportunity issue, and some might even say it's a civil rights issue. If it's legal, then you should be able to do it anywhere. I sit on that issue, and so I sit on the side of Chris Goldstein. I think if you tell people you have to regulate a legal substance to a particular neighborhood, beer has an odor too, and vodka, when people are drinking a lot of it, has odor too, and cigarettes.
Right, but they can't drink on the street. They're not allowed to legally. I know it happens.
You can smoke,
of course,
on the street.
You can smoke on the street.
Yeah,
right.
I hate the smell of cigarette smoke. So, I mean, are we going to regulate cigarette smokers to a particular neighborhood? I mean, I think it becomes a issue there of fairness, right?
Mm. I think that's a good point. I mean, I think it's fair. I mean, we have started, right, to enforce smoking in parks now. You know, people can't be smoking in parks. And again, I don't know how much that's actually enforced. But for example, you're not supposed to be smoking in Rittenhouse. You can't smoke in restaurants, which was true, what, 10 years ago even?
Yeah, but I think the discussion is where we're moving to. If we're moving to full legalization, I mean, at the time of this recording, you know, the attitude's even changing in Pennsylvania. More people are favoring legalization.
There's a Franklin Marshall poll that just came out. And it polled Pennsylvania voters and said that 56% are actually in favor of legalization.
Right. So it means we're going to get to legalization at some point. And so I think we have to get ahead of the conversation of how are we going to be fair and who gets to smoke it, why, and more importantly, where. If somebody wants to sit on their steps and smoke it and the next door neighbor says they complain that they don't like the smell of marijuana, that's almost saying that, well, I don't like how loud your radio is playing. I mean, you can't call the police on that. It may be a quality of life issue. But if no one's breaking the law, people should be left alone. And I think that we're going to get into murky territory if we try to create, you know, smoke zones in certain neighborhoods where people have to go. Because first of all, then there's going to be so many people in that park, right? And then that's going to draw suspicion. So I think that we need to lighten up, no pun intended, but
well,
you know.
The whole discussion, I was just kind of playing devil's advocate with that, and I think Chris and Flood made a really convincing argument for why, you know, it shouldn't be limited. But here, I'm going to say—
Just don't smoke it in church.
I'm going to say one thing, though. It seems like all the polling says that we're moving closer and closer to legalization in Pennsylvania. Here's the one thing. I think we might be further away than people think. Mm. And I think the reason is, the optics of legalizing marijuana right now, I don't think are very good, because we have this opioid crisis happening all across the country. A lot of the statistics say it's 5 times as deadly as the crack cocaine epidemic was in the late 80s and early 90s.
And five times less is punitive, but that's a different podcast.
Right, absolutely. So, but I just think that, you know, particularly in Pennsylvania and the demographics in Pennsylvania, I think it's going to be hard to overcome that, that even though, you know, the marijuana enforcement and opioids and heroin enforcement are completely two separate things, two separate drugs, the addictive qualities of the drugs are completely different issues. However, just the optics of saying, hey, we're going to be more lax on any type of drug enforcement when the opioid crisis is happening, I think it's going to be a difficult political hurdle to overcome.
I actually don't. I disagree completely. I think it'd probably be easier, particularly because it's been proven now that marijuana can help people wean off of their opioid addiction. They're seeing that it's an economic asset. And so the only argument that people have against it is one that's rooted in either ignorance, religion, or a mixture of the two. So I don't see where a legitimate argument could be presented where someone says we can't legalize marijuana because people are abusing heroin.
I think that's all true, and I totally agree with that. I just think the optics and the politically. I mean, even Governor Wolf, Democrat, has said that he'd be in favor of decriminalization statewide, but not legalization.
I think this is one of those moments where they have to say, what's the saying? Fuck the optics. I haven't heard that one, Fled. Say it again. Fuck the optics. Hey, go ahead and legalize it.
So. We're going to introduce our guest now. So we already mentioned
Chris. Quite the segue, right?
We already mentioned Chris Goldstein at the top. I'll introduce Chris, and then we'll introduce Lynn Washington. So this is a joint conversation with the two of them. Chris Goldstein has the writer and columnist for the Philly 420 blog, which you can find on philly.com. Chris was also one of the main activists to spearhead, I guess, the movement for marijuana decriminalization in Philadelphia. Philadelphia, 2014 became the first major city in the country, or the biggest city in the country, to decriminalize small amounts of marijuana. Chris and another activist named N.A. Poe, during Occupy Philadelphia, kind of began this, eventually got Jim Kenney, who is now the mayor, was then a city councilman, to sponsor legislation and decriminalize marijuana in Philadelphia. So now him and Lynn are teaching a class at Temple University about news and the history of coverage of marijuana. So we're going to get into a wide-ranging conversation with the two of them. And then Flood, so you know Lynn a little bit, probably better than me, and maybe you can give some background.
So Lynn is somebody who's covered the marijuana issue, legalization, decriminalization, criminal justice aspect of it for years, probably almost two decades. He's a former writer at the Philadelphia Tribune. He's a journalism professor at Temple University. He's a co-teacher or co-facilitator of the class Marijuana in the News with, I guess, Chris Goldstein. And he's all around badass, you know, really smart guy, great writer. He's one of the people who called out the black politicians back in 2015 for not supporting the legislation you just spoke about Jim Kenney. And so I think when you get Lynn Washington and Chris Goldstein talking about marijuana in one room, you're bound for some fun and for some good conversation. So I'm looking forward to this. Chris Goldstein is a marijuana activist with Philly Normal. And Dr. Professor Lynn Washington of Temple University is a marijuana researcher who's covered this topic a lot. Together, they are the teaching force behind Marijuana in the News, and that's a course at Temple University. Welcome to Pushback.
Thank you, Chris. Hi.
First question is, Lynn, you've described Chris as a, quote, encyclopedia of weed, end quote. And my question for Chris is, a few years ago, Philadelphia became the first big city in the country to decriminalize marijuana. I don't think many people before that had this connotation of weed. Philadelphia maybe as a weed capital, say that like Denver or the Bay Area is. Chris, can you tell us a little bit, like, what's the history of weed in Philadelphia, if you can give like a short, maybe minute answer? And what are some of the things people might be surprised about with that history?
Oh, well, you know, because Philly is a history town, we have to go way back for the history of marijuana here. I mean, it was William Penn who founded Pennsylvania and started Philadelphia. And William Penn was a great Quaker. He was a great guy, but he was also a capitalist. And hemp was a big part of his game. Hemp farming was massive here in Pennsylvania in the early part of the colony. And then when William Penn's wife ended up taking over for him after a series of strokes, she also expanded the hemp farming empire. Skip ahead into the 1790s, and you have President George Washington sitting at the first presidential mansion at the corner of 6th and Market, writing a letter to his gardener back home in Virginia saying, "May the hemp seed be sown anywhere." You know, it's like that famous Washington hemp quote.
I love that.
And then skip ahead into the also the fact around that same time, you know, in the 1700s, hashish and hemp hashish and actual marijuana are being smoked out of the clay tavern pipes in the coffee houses and taverns that we would think of as being part and parcel with the American Revolution history part of things. But marijuana comes to America really in the form that we smoke it today in the 1800s, and it comes up from the the southern United States, Mexico, and the Caribbean, because the British were bringing slaves from India and Sri Lanka to places like the Dominican Republic and Jamaica and Haiti, and they had brought sativa with them. It's called ganjika in India and Sri Lanka, and it's still called ganja in Jamaica today because of that. And in the 1800s, it comes on up to here. In 1876 at Fairmount Park, there was the Centennial Fair, the 1876 Centennial Fair. President Ulysses Grant opened the fair, and there was a Turkish hashish parlor. The Sultan of Turkey
That's amazing.
Actually put 3.8 tons of hashish on a ship that docked in Philadelphia's port, and they moved the tons of hash off the ship from the docks at Philadelphia there almost by Race Street, where the Ben Franklin Bridge is now, out to the fairgrounds at Fairmount Park, where people went into the hash parlor and ate and smoked the hash all day long for the many months of the World Expo. And now the modern history of marijuana is that basically everybody smokes it. It's a very commonly used thing amongst all classes, categories of our city and society in Philadelphia. The big problem with us is that we haven't legalized it. We can't really make money on it tax-wise, and people can't have regulated businesses for it. Now, look, Colorado just turned in the lowest unemployment rate in the nation, and you tell me that has nothing to do with growing weed.
Why do you know so much about marijuana, Chris? Where does that come from?
Why do I know so much, or we know so much?
Well, I mean, I assume Lynn knows so much, but he's a professor. You know, he has an excuse to know so much.
Well, I mean, I've taken on marijuana legalization as my movement. I mean, I see it as a civil rights and a social justice movement.
Right, I dig it, but why? There's something deeper there, right? There's a reason you're doing this.
Well, I believe in it. I'm not just into legalizing marijuana because it's a good economic option. I'm a Quaker. I mean, it sounds corny, but I've taken the blue pill on social justice. I really believe in it. And I believe that this war on drugs is not really a war on drugs. It's a war on people who are making choices that other people don't like.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to get to. This sounds like your advocacy is part of your value system. It's not just because you like marijuana, right? It's part of your value system.
It's true. And you know what's weird is that I think that when I first started in this 15, 16 years ago, like everybody was like me. We were all a bunch of idealistic social justice and the drug war people. And in the time I've been involved with marijuana reform, as things became legal, there has been this industry that's developed around marijuana. And they have a different agenda for legalization and for regulation than I do. And that's been tough to take. I don't see the industry as being legalization advocates. I see them as a happy accident, the result of social justice reform. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So I want to bring Lynn into the conversation in just a sec. I just want to really quickly go back to the centennial, the history that Chris just said. And I believe, I could be wrong, but I believe at the centennial, they brought the first bicycle to America. And I just wanted to basically make the point, you know, as old as people have been riding bicycles, I guess they've been smoking hashish, which is pretty amazing to think about. So Lynn.
Oh, yeah.
You've and Chris have been teaching this course, and I feel like even over the last few years in Philadelphia, there's been a number of marijuana news has, I guess, been kind of exploding. There's, Chris's Philly 420 column on Philly.com. Dan Gross just launched Elevated Nation. Philly Mag had a cover story in December 2015. Given that you're teaching marijuana in the news, do you have a critique of coverage locally? I mean, what have you noticed, I guess, in the local market about how people have been approaching this, whether it's as a civil rights issue or just as a, I guess, recreational issue?
Well, the news coverage has expanded, and it has also become more more
so I'll say more probative, more substantive. It has become less of a, there's those people smoking, we feel, you know, those darn potheads.
Yeah.
People are starting to look at this for the social justice aspects of it, because here in Philadelphia, as in so many places across the country, we see it a huge racial disparity where blacks are arrested and processed through the system in extraordinarily large numbers. But historically, when we look at it, and I'm just going to piggyback a little bit on what my colleague Chris had talked about, that when you look at news coverage, you see marijuana in the news in Philadelphia for decades. Back in the 1930s, I'm thinking right now of a headline that said that Philadelphia and St. Louis were the places where marijuana was the worst. And this is from Harry Anslinger, the guy he talked about, who was the man who pushed for the illegalization, and that's not even a word, but the prohibition of marijuana, and did it on a very racist basis. Two things were going on. I mean, he brought up the black boogeyman and was very clear about it in terms of jazz, you know, this marijuana inspires him to do their satanic music, which was jazz and swing. They were saying that this substance causes white women to have sexual relations with entertainers, i.e. black guys. But then there was something else going on in the Midwest, part of the country. There was a recession going on in the 30s, right? And they started demonizing Hispanics, particularly Mexicans, as the persons responsible for taking your job. So that was rolled into it. So we got to get rid of these Mexicans. This doesn't sound like something that's going on now.
Well, it's interesting. If we could just stop right there. One of the things, you talk about marijuana in the news, you know, Jeff Sessions' deputy, I can't remember his name, but the guy he's got right under him, his deputy, they're talking about now using marijuana as a way to find probable cause to deport people. That's going to be, you know, trying to find.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, trying to find Latinos, particularly undocumented immigrants who have marijuana on them, and using that as the case for deportation. So that has some historical context in it, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It seems like these bad policies and practices, there's no learning from history, and they're doing this and repeating it again, and they're creating boogeymen in the public's eyes. So here we have these Hispanics. Trump has been running this line that, you know, Mexicans are all drug dealers, and so if you're found with anything, I mean, the way they're deporting people now, it used to be that they had to commit felonies, and particularly serious felonies. Now it's all the way down to misdemeanors.
Yeah.
And then they're getting to the point where they are arresting people inside courthouses for deportation when these people are coming there to comply with the law that allowed them to stay in the country. So we see lawlessness from this law and order administration. Mm-hmm. But I just wanted to continue real quickly because it's very important, pivotal in terms of where we are now and why we are here. In the 70s, when you read some of the newspaper accounts, I mean, I look at, say, the Philadelphia Tribune, every couple of months there were public opinion polls about, do you support the legalization of marijuana? And people were very supportive of it. In 1970, there was a state legislator, a guy from Pittsburgh, actually went to the high school that I went to in Pittsburgh. His name was Joseph Rhodes. He introduced a bill to decriminalize marijuana in Pennsylvania, 1977. He had the support of the Pennsylvania Medical Association, the Pennsylvania Bar Association, and the Prosecutors Association of Pennsylvania was not fully supportive, but they weren't in full opposition of it. He could not get support at all. There was one then state representative, a guy named John White Jr., a very prominent politician in the city. He was supportive of it. And if you look at from 1977 to when Chris Goldstein and his colleagues convinced now Mayor Kenney, who was then a councilman, to push for the decriminalization, when we look at that time span and we think of the thousands, the tens of thousands of persons whose lives have been ruined with an arrest for simple possession. One small joint, you know.
Yeah.
But it's always been demonized.
The public will back in 1977 wasn't very high. Are you saying?
Oh, no,
saying
it wasn't. There was a lot of support, but in terms of proper society or so-called proper society, and definitely the political leadership is very adamantly against it. And again, in the 70s, it's, you know, we're talking, it's still in the Nixon law and order era, although Nixon had resigned.
Lynn, you've talked a lot about
black politicians in their role in kind of being in the pop mm-hmm. movement, we wouldn't be here where we are today in terms of having this conversation about maybe the renewal on the, of the war on drugs if President Obama had maybe taken a step forward and declassified marijuana as a Schedule I drug, right? I mean, what was the justification, you think, for not doing that? And why wasn't there more pressure, public pressure, from the black community and marijuana activists in general?
Well, President Obama was very clear that he didn't want to expend any of his political capital on this issue.
Mm-hmm.
However,
it's just President, clear, is it because he didn't want to be seen as the black guy pushing for weed, or he just didn't think it was?
Well, it could be a combination of things, because we have to understand, I mean, he was walking such a precarious line by being the black guy mm-hmm. in the White House. And why should he get into this? But, you know, parallel to that, President Obama is exhibit A for all of the deliberate misinformation that has been put forth on marijuana for decades. One of the things that they say about marijuana is that it actually impairs brain function. It makes you stupid. It makes you crazy. You know, you'll never be a success in life. You'll always be lazy and smoking, you know, 28 joints a day. Well, here's a guy who admitted, and I say a guy, I mean President Obama, admitted that he smoked marijuana when he went to Columbia. And it is inferred that he smoked marijuana when he was at the Harvard Law School, where he became the editor of the Harvard Law Review. That's the top position for a law student at Harvard. So if he smoked it, law school or not, immaterial. He has admitted that he did it in high school and he did it as an undergrad. So if it had those kind of adverse effects, how did he get to where he got? In the black community, for too many decades, people have just bought into this myth that marijuana is bad. You know, we can sit around while we're smoking cigars and cigarettes and getting drunk on cheap wine or even expensive wine or rock gut liquor or top shelf scotch, and we're going to condemn marijuana. How hypocritical is that? If, in fact, the leadership in the black community really was concerned about black people, we wouldn't be in this situation now. The same arrest disparity statistics that Mayor Kenney put into the resolution that led to the decriminalization of marijuana were known by all members of city council if they cared to look at it. Yet it was a white city councilman that pushed this legislation and not any of the black members in city council.
You know, obviously legalization hasn't happened in Pennsylvania yet, but there's been bills introduced to basically the process would work that it would be sold at state stores, either within the current liquor store structure or I guess maybe separate state stores, but similar to how liquor is sold in Pennsylvania. Getting back to this question of equity and trying to make sure, I guess, that within this green rush or this, you know, virtual gold rush, that, you know, the black community gets some of these economic benefits. Is that the best way to go about it through the state store system? Do you think that there could be equity within that structure, or do you think we should look at something else, Chris?
I don't think that the state store system worked for alcohol, and I don't think that a state store system is going to work for marijuana. I think maybe the state, now that the Republicans have been privatizing marijuana or liquor and putting beer in sheets and hard liquor in grocery stores, maybe the state store people in the PLCB are looking at marijuana as some sort of saving grace for their failing system.
That's interesting.
But I don't think that we should throw them that line. I think that my view of legalization is that the small business operators of today, the underground operators, get a chance to go legit. Mm-hmm. Like most of America doesn't make $1 million on marijuana in the underground economy. People just like get by. It's a nice source of like extra income or something like that. And I don't think that many people are going to go out and grow a warehouse of marijuana. But if they could, like their tomatoes, have a farm stand, put their extra tomatoes out in a farm stand, make a couple extra bucks, they can grow a couple extra ounces of marijuana in their personal garden and sell it or give it away. There's nothing wrong with that either.
Right.
We need a retail system. I mean, consumers need a place to go to easily buy good quality, safe marijuana products. But at the end of the day, it's we haven't even achieved that yet. I mean, California is coming close because they've had this sort of gray market regulated marijuana economy for 20 years since 1996. And now they're attempting to, you know, implement full legalization under a very strict regulatory scheme. But they've had this community of people grow and share and sell marijuana, much like not like a drug, but more like tomatoes and an agricultural product, quite frankly. And again, my view of legalization is that I think people are fully entitled to get the most refined cannabis products for their diseases and conditions. But I also believe that a free market should exist in it, and there should not be the boot of the government on this plant like there isn't a boot on corn or tomatoes, for God's sakes.
Speaking of arrests and race, we have to address the elephant in the room, and we have to get to this concept of what we were talking about with the raid that just happened in Philadelphia, mm-hmm. Chris, and the way that it's been talked about in the news and the way that it's been perceived in the public. Chris, before we even go deeper, just give me a quick 60 seconds of what happened at the warehouse, the raid in Philadelphia.
Well, I guess I just got caught up in what was like an old school speakeasy raid. Like if you've seen, you know, old movies of like the raids in the 1920s where they'd come in and bust up the beer barrels and make everybody stand against the wall. That was essentially what the Philadelphia Narcotics Department did this weekend. There was a marijuana party where like people got together and consumed cannabis in various different ways. And because they won't really rent, you know, it would be great if the Union Transfer or some venues in Philly, if you walked up to them and were like, hey, I want to bring a couple hundred people in for a show and we're all going to smoke marijuana inside. They're not going to rent to you. So marijuana social events tend to happen in like underground warehouses and things like that. This isn't just in Philly. I mean, these happen all over the country every single weekend. These are not terribly unique. It's just that Philly had built this one party up that was a little bit more open on social media, and the police department used that to their advantage by observing it all and then infiltrating it, acting as undercovers. They attended these parties and blended in as medical cannabis patients and recreational cannabis consumers. And so this wasn't, you know, it wasn't like there was a marijuana party happening and the neighbors complained and they decided to roll out the local police department. This was a well-planned, year-long investigation with undercover officers by the Philadelphia Narcotics Department. And what happened to me was I was standing in front of the building. I was inside for hours, and it was, kind of a warm day. It was raining outside. I smoke cigarettes, so I went outside to smoke a cigarette. And, believe it or not, at marijuana parties, smoking cigarettes is still taboo. So I went outside to smoke a cigarette out front, and there were these two security guards, I guess, who had been there for the party or whatever. And these two group of plainclothes police officers wearing jeans and T-shirts and small badges on sort of neck chains around their neck came around the corner and said, get the fuck up against the wall. They didn't say, hey, this is the police and this is a raid. They said, hey, you, get the fuck up against the wall. And I was surprised. I thought we were being robbed. The security guards had very similar badges around their chains. The guys who rolled up were plain clothes, white, scruffy. In my mind, I call them hillbillies. The first guy grabbed me, pushed me up against the wall. He spread my legs. He had my hands up above my head against a brick wall next to the two security guys. They were concerned about them because I guess they were armed security guards. And I didn't know that, but I realized that very quickly. They were both, the security guys, I guess, were very calm. They answered all the questions. They were completely compliant. They were both African-American, both security guards. They just went along with the whole thing. I was like, at the moment the guy said, hey, get the fuck up against the wall. I said, who are you? He goes, who the fuck do you think we are? We have badges. I said, those guys have badges. He goes, we're the fucking police. Get up the fuck against the wall. I mean, it was just like that.
Just to advance it, what did the police find when they raided the space?
Well, they found a few hundred people upstairs at a marijuana party. They say in their police report they seized 50 pounds of marijuana and 100 pounds of THC-infused edibles and other products. Now,
handguns,
there were people there.
Correct.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
And handguns and money.
Yeah, the guns, I guess, were the security guys. They were, like I said, they were armed security guards out front. I think that those were the guns that they recovered. I wasn't aware of anybody having guns. But yes, money. Yes, definitely money.
It was $50,000 in cash, correct?
Again, there was a raid on Tomasio's house. So it's unclear if the cash was seized at the party or the house.
So when the reporting came out, we've heard people talk about that it was unnecessary, that it was an overkill. Even the mayor said it was overkill. Lynn, you know, one of the conversations that they had on this week about this issue was that it wasn't overkill, that if on paper, if those things were found in another neighborhood in a different context, then it would have been appropriate. How do you see that? When we're talking about marijuana in the news, do you feel like that was covered fairly? Do you feel like what some might have been left out? Do you hear and understand when people say if it happened differently, they wouldn't have been called overkill?
Well, the coverage initially, when these sort of things happen, you just go on what the police say. So they said, you know, four guns were recovered. So that was the news, and that has that kind of scare factor into people's minds. But as you heard Chris describe, as someone, an eyewitness who was there, those guns were really not just guns that were there by some criminals or AK-47 assault rifles. They were guns in the possession of security guards and or people who were legally registered to have those firearms. I think the mayor made a very appropriate observation that given the nature of the real drug problem in Philadelphia, the resources, the time, the manpower and women power that was devoted to cracking down on some people who were there for some for adult use, recreational purposes, many there for medical purposes, to have that level of enforcement when you have just literally blocks away one of the epicenters of the heroin problem in the United States, it raises questions. What happened a week and a half or so before that raid? The heroin problem in Philadelphia is so bad that Dr. Oz, with a network television crew, was walking down one of the heroin corridors. So where is that type of activity directed to that level of drug problem? And at the same time, in the Philadelphia Inquirer, Philly.com, on Sunday, story about the pot raid, but then also a story about three women who observed a egregious incident of police brutality where these undercover cops rolled up on this college student who was working as a pizza delivery man and shot him and disfigured him. And these women are lawyers, and they were saying that, you know, how the police muffed the investigation because the investigation went on and the police department decided that there was no violation for these police officers violating police procedure. So there's more serious problems, which is not to say that the way that particular party was operated, but it just goes to show the absurdities of the drug problems. If you're in Colorado, if you're in Oregon, if you're in Washington, if you're in Alaska, it's okay. Mm-hmm. But here we're going to make a big deal out of it.
You talked to me, Chris, about the evolution of the decrim, what could be next, and that we've already in Philadelphia decriminalized the possession of marijuana, but you think that we should decriminalize the selling of marijuana and the social gathering of it. Can you just explain that, and then Lynn, just weigh in on that, and then we'll wrap up.
Well, yeah, in Washington, D.C., it's legal to give away a couple of ounces of marijuana to other people, to other adults. Mm-hmm. That's the legal non-remunerative, you know, you've decriminalized giving it away. In Washington, D.C., it's legal to grow six plants in your home. You know, there's nothing illegal about it. That's, I guess, decriminalizing home cultivation. Call it legalizing, decriminalizing there, but... yeah, I think that the evolution for Philadelphia looks like Washington, D.C., is a city that allows its residents to grow, possess, and give away marijuana, and it is no violation of the law, and it's not abnormal in any way. I think more cities in America are moving in that fashion. I mean, look, since they've legalized marijuana fully in California, you know, Colorado and Massachusetts, the cities of Boston and Denver and Los Angeles and San Francisco part and parcel get to do this. We may need to do it on our own in Philly because of the way our legislature runs, but I think that Philadelphia is the kind of city like Washington, D.C., that can stand strong on its own and make sure that our citizens have an extra level of freedom and liberty, not less. And that's what marijuana brings you.
There needs to be clearly some changes in the law and the approach. The public sentiment is way out ahead of our political leadership. And if you look at money, if you look at health, if you look at jobs, this is an industry that or a area that could address all of those. And it's really time to change. I mean, everything is not for everybody. I mean, if we look at, say, an Eddie Long, religion is not for everybody. Mm-hmm. Okay, politics. I mean, we can go down to like journalism. I mean, let's be real. Mm-hmm. So it's not saying that, you know, you should run out Johnny Appleseed and put a joint in everybody's mouth. But for those who want to do that, they should be able to, because there is no social or long-term harm to those people or to people on either side of them. I mean, right now, what is it? A few weeks ago, the federal government said they won't allow cell phones on airplanes because mm-hmm. some people don't want to hear that talk on an airplane. Mm-hmm. Some people don't want to see somebody smoking joint on the street. Understandable. But you should not stop that person who does want to smoke in the privacy of their home from doing it.
And Chris, how can people get in touch with you? Thank you guys so much for being here. How can people follow up with you guys? Lynn, you first.
I'm at Temple University. Anybody wants to get in touch with me, can get in touch with me there. I'm, honored to teach this class with Chris Goldstein. I've been writing about marijuana since the mid-70s, and I'll continue to write about it.
Where can people find your writings?
Just Google me, Lynn Washington.
That's when you know you're famous. You just tell people to Google you.
Just Google me. Or go to the post office. You'll see me on the wall.
Chris Goldstein, how can people get in touch with you and read your column?
Best way to find me is up at philly.com. You can look up the Philly 420 column or up on Twitter, which is where I think the quality social media is these days, and that's at Freedom is Green.
Awesome.
Thanks so much for joining us, Lynn and Chris, and thanks for the conversation.
Thank you, everybody, for being tuned in and downloading Pushback. We really appreciate it. Remember to subscribe on iTunes. Tell all your friends about it if you don't have iTunes, and I'm sure not many people who don't. But if you don't, go to phillymag.com/pushback and bookmark that, or you can always search through wordradio.com. The podcast will always publish there. We got great episodes coming up soon, so stay tuned. For Malcolm Burnley, I'm Flood the Drummer, and until next time, I'm Drumming for Justice.